Hello, this is Brian Ventrudo, editor of OneMinuteAstronomer.com. Our topic today is urban astronomy. Now, many city-based astronomers believe you need dark country skies to see faint deep sky objects like galaxies and nebula. After all, in dark sky you get better contrast in your telescope than you can in washed-out city skies. And it's true, dark sky is almost always better than light-polluted sky for stargazing. But if you live in a decent-sized city and you think that you have to hold out for dark sky all the time, there's a practical problem here. It takes time and energy and more than a few dollars to truck your telescope out an hour or so outside the city. And let's face it, the harder you make it for yourself to get out with your telescope, the more likely it is you're not going to do much observing at all, and you might eventually lose interest in this wonderful pastime of amateur astronomy. But the truth is, you can see many beautiful celestial objects, even in bright skies, if you know where and how to look and if you know a few tricks of the trade. So to help you out, I've got on the line today Mr. Rod Malise, also known as Uncle Rod. Rod is the author of The Urban Astronomer's Guide, which is part of Patrick Moore's Practical Astronomy series published by Springer Verlag. Rod's been an amateur astronomer, well, for maybe more years than he cares to admit. But he knows a thing or two about tackling light-polluted city skies and getting the most out of a small telescope in the city. Hello, Rod.
Hello, Brian. Thanks very much for having me on, buddy.
Thanks for joining me. So tell us a bit about your background in astronomy. How did you get into this captivating pastime? Why astronomy instead of, say, birdwatching or coin collecting?
Well, Brian, that's one question I probably can't answer. As far back as I can remember, at least till I was 4 or 5 years old, I had always been interested in what I call the great out there. I guess kids' interests come and go, but astronomy, science, math, those were things that must have taken hold at a very early age for me and never let up. I can't tell you the first time I wondered about the night sky. I can go back to the first astronomy book I ever got, but I honestly can't tell you a time I was not interested in astronomy.
Well, I started about the same age myself, about 4 or 5, and I still have a few of my books from those old days. Tell me about your first telescope. What did you have, and at what age?
I guess my first real telescope was the telescope I did not want. The first telescope I remember actually wanting, and that was the point I actually realized you could own your own telescope. A real telescope was one of the Gilbert, A.C. Gilbert, 2-inch reflecting telescopes that were popular in the 1950s.
Gosh, okay.
Unfortunately, we were what you'd call these days po folks. So
okay.
The $29.95 or whatever the heck Mr. A.C. Gilbert wanted for his Wonderscope was not forthcoming. But my old man, an engineer by profession, was a creative sort and a scrounger, and he found a little Tasco 3-inch Newtonian hidden in a downtown pawn shop and rescued it for me.
Oh, excellent.
It wasn't much of a telescope, but that's all it took for me to take off and start flying, Brian.
Well, that's funny because my first telescope, it would have been a decade later, I suppose, but my first was a 3-inch Tasco reflector also. I'm not sure where it is these days. It still lives somewhere, but that was quite a telescope, and you could see.
Well,
quite
that's the way I'd put it. Well, mine was quite a telescope, maybe not in a good way, and I'm not sure what happened to it, and I'm not sure I want to know.
Oh, so you don't use it anymore?
It was gone with the wind probably sometime back in the mid-60s.
Oh, there you go. Now, what kind of telescope gear have you got today? Have you got one or many telescopes, or what do you use?
I'd be embarrassed to tell you and your listeners how many telescopes are hanging out here at Chaos Manor South right now, but I will tell you what we use mostly. For visual observing, we generally use a 12.5-inch Dobsonian.
Okay.
Equipped with a set of digital setting circles. For visual, we often use our Nexstar 11 GPS.
Okay.
Celestron
yeah.
C11.
Yeah. All right. Now, with nice big telescopes like that, do you specialize in a particular kind of astronomy? Are you doing visual stuff? Are you doing photography? What's your specialty, if anything, these days?
I tell people I'm the original astronomy dilettante, that one night I might look at the moon, and the next night I might be hunting Higgs and galaxy groups, and the next night I might be imaging faint nebulae.
Okay.
Part of that is because I am an astronomy writer, and I do quite a few reviews, so I may be asked to review a mount and take pictures using that telescope mount when what I'm more interested in at the moment is visual observing. But maybe that's good because it keeps me interested in astronomy and informed on amateur astronomy on a lot of different levels.
Okay, okay. Now, a lot of well-known amateur astronomers, and I would certainly consider you to be well-known, being a published author and speaker. A lot of well-known amateurs like David Levy or Jack Newton have set themselves up in places that have extremely dark sky. But you live around Mobile, Alabama, correct?
That's right, Brian.
What's the sky like there?
It's pretty putrid, actually. But many amateur astronomers, well-known or not so well-known, while I do astronomy for money in that I teach it at the university level and write about it, I'm uh-huh. also tied to, my workplace, and so is my wife. And for a lot of us, that means that we make the best of the skies we have, whether they are good or bad. And that's the bottom line for everybody. Make the best of what you've got.
Okay, okay. Well, that's a good point, actually. We'd like to explore a bit more here. Now, a lot of people, as I said before, think you need a dark sky to see much of anything. Now, as the author of the Urban Astronomer's Guide, I'm assuming you don't agree with that.
Well, I do and I don't, Brian. Let me preface this all by saying that I certainly don't recommend nothing but urban astronomy. I am a firm believer in, one, getting out to dark sites, and two, joining in the battle against light pollution, maybe by joining the International Dark Sky Association, the IDA.
Right, right.
Certainly there's nothing that stimulates or helps continue your interest in astronomy than getting out where it's really dark, even if that's a club site only, an hour from home.
Yeah.
But the other side of that is that you can't remain interested in astronomy when you only get out once a month.
Right.
And how many club observing sessions are ruined by weather, and that means maybe you don't get out every month, maybe you get out every few months, and you just can't keep going that way.
Right,
so
right.
If you're going to remain interested in amateur astronomy and remain interested in the night sky, you're going to have to get out more often. You're going to have to get out into the backyard and make the best of what you've got there.
Okay, okay. Well, fair enough. And I'm from an observing site also. I'm in suburban Ottawa, Canada, so it's not much it's not much fun here, but you can see a few things. Now, from your locale, for example, what can you expect to see from in town with a modest telescope? What kind of objects?
Well, in Canada, ain't that north of the Mason-Dixon line, boy?
It is.
That's what I've heard. Anyway, seriously, what can you see from the average light-polluted sky, and maybe average light-polluted sky, by that we're saying maybe magnitude 4 or 5 limit, somewhere
sure,
in there. What
sure.
you can see is the entire Messier list, the entire list of Charles Messier's deep sky objects. You can see many other
clusters,
nebulae, and galaxy besides.
Okay, so that's 100-plus objects, essentially.
100-plus objects,
yeah.
And if you're once you work beyond the Messier, there are plenty of NGC objects, that's the next list up for most amateur astronomers,
yeah.
To see as well. You couldn't see everything in your backyard in a year or 5 years or 10 years, even if you really worked at it. There's plenty to be seen. It's just a matter of getting out there and seeing it.
Okay, so more than just the moon and planets, the bright stuff.
Far, far more than just the moon and planets.
So you can see all these things from your backyard.
I live exactly 2 miles from the downtown of a city of 250,000, and I have seen the entire Messier from my backyard, including the supposedly hard ones like M101 and M74.
Right, right.
And many of those with a 4-inch telescope.
With a 4-inch?
So there is no lack of things to see.
Okay, okay. Now, that reminds me, your place is called Chaos Manor South. You've mentioned it once. Dare I ask where the name came from?
Well, actually, I was inspired by one of my heroes in the writing game, Jerry Purnell.
Oh, yes.
Many of you may remember him as a science fiction author.
Yeah, yeah.
And also, he had a long time running an article, column in a computer magazine, Byte, in the early days of personal computers.
Oh,
and I
yes.
remember sitting down and reading one of his articles one time where he referred to their home as Chaos Manor. And I said, okay. Dang, that's just like this place. Maybe this is Chaos Manor South.
Okay.
And that it's constantly, if you walked in the door, you'd see stacks of astronomy and technical and mathematical books and computers and telescopes and you name it, and we love it.
Well, excellent, excellent. Okay, I didn't know that. That's a great story.
Now you know. Now it can be told.
Now, so you've got a backyard with a decent view. Mine is so-so. Have you got a fairly clear view of the horizon?
I used to. As the years have gone on, the backyard has grown up more and more and more to the point where I'm slowly being forced out.
This is
down here, living in the historic district, as we do, you do not cut down a tree.
Okay.
But it did provide many a year of observing pleasure, and we're reaching the end maybe of our tenure here in the next little while as my wife Dorothy and I reach slowly, ever so slowly, retirement age when we can go out, whether the pitch black side or not, have an open area and a real observatory out somewhere.
Okay.
But this yard near downtown provided year after year of pleasure.
All right. Now for someone who doesn't have a backyard or maybe their yard is more advanced than yours and the trees have grown up around it, or maybe they live in an apartment, can you suggest some options in the city
well,
for
we
finding
talk about this in
a good
depth
site.
In the book, and I really recommend, without trying to plug the book too much, I recommend that because it's a subject with a lot of ins and outs for the city dweller, and it involves things like police and crime and things like that. But the long and short is that for the city dweller, without a detached house and a backyard, three things suggest themselves. First of all is a balcony. Just about anybody, or at least many people living in an apartment, will probably have a balcony of some kind. You would normally think you can't see much from there, but actually that's not quite the case. Especially if you have a balcony facing east or west, you can take in a large swath of the sky.
Mm-hmm.
And it has the added advantage of bringing you up above street level and maybe out of some of the ambient light pollution down there.
Okay.
Now, what if you don't have a balcony? The next best or maybe even better thing is if your apartment building or other urban digs has a flat roof and you have access to it. You know, all those things will depend on several factors, but if you do have that situation, a rooftop can probably be the best urban observing locale of all. You've got a large open area. You've probably got a very wide expanse of the sky blocked only by adjacent buildings.
Right.
And
right.
Again, you are up above all the street lights and ambient light pollution down below. And,
mm-hmm.
and we can talk about that a little bit more later if you like, but sky glow is not the whole of the urban light pollution equation. Much of the problem is from nearby ambient lights.
Okay.
But and the third possibility I would offer is that almost every North American and European city of any size has an astronomy club. Y'all may not know this, but even New York City has a large and active astronomy club. And by active, I don't mean that they just sit around and talk. They get out and observe in New York City locations, and they see a lot.
Oh, I did not know that.
The advantage of that is that if you can approach someplace like a children's museum or a science museum as an organized group, they may have a parking lot or a rooftop or some other area that is much better for observing than what you could locate on your own. But the bottom line is be creative. And again, I want to recommend that y'all look in the section on observing site choice in the book, because there, like I said, there's several safety and other concerns for urban astronomers that I'd really like all of y'all to be aware of, and I'm not going to take up a long time to go into it here because it is a rather involved subject. But the bottom line is there are urban observing sites, and you can find one.
Okay. All right, fair enough. All right, so if you've got a site and you can't wait to get out there, let's talk about telescopes a bit. Now, does light pollution affect the kind of telescope you should use for city observing? Do you need a special city telescope?
It's in a way you do, and it certainly does, and not in the way that most people think. And one thing I'd like to do right here before we go any further is debunk what I call the urban aperture myth.
Yes.
You may have heard people say that, well, if you live in the city or in the heavily light-polluted suburbs, you should not buy a large telescope. It will just collect extra light, and you won't see as much in a large telescope as you would see in a smaller one.
Yes.
And the answer, being polite, is the word rubbish.
Okay.
If you want to just – I could go on and on about this silly story, but if you want to prove or disprove it for yourself, get a 4-inch telescope, get a 12-inch telescope, set them up in your city observing locations and point them at M13. Use eyepieces that give similar magnification and take a look. In the 4-inch, you're going to see a bright smudge, and the 12-inch, you're going to see a ball of stars. I won't belabor the point, but the bottom line is that is just a myth. In the city in particular, underline that, in particular, aperture always wins, all things being equal. In dark locations, small aperture telescopes can perform incredibly well, but and keep up very well with larger telescopes. Such is not the case in the city. In the city, all things being equal, always choose the largest telescope. Well, all things aren't always equal, so let me amend that to say choose the largest telescope you can handle.
Right.
Obviously, if you live on a fifth floor walk up, you can't have a 16-inch solid tube Dobsonian. Get the large. If you're going to observe in the city, get the largest aperture telescope that you can handle, that you can store, and that you can move around. That is very, very important.
Okay. Now, we're not here to plug for telescope manufacturers, but is someone with a backyard and a decent sized view, can you make a couple of recommendations for a good telescope?
In general terms. Actually, the type of telescope you use is not overly important as far as design or manufacturers. If you look in the book, one of the images is of the telescopes that I used for, doing the observations in the book, and you won't find a more motley lot anywhere. The telescopes I used for the book range from a 3-inch short tube 80 to a 12-inch Meade Dobsonian and everything in between.
Okay.
I guess if I had to say anything, it would go back to the urban aperture deal. Choose a telescope that is a minimum of 8 inches in aperture. The other thing I would say is don't worry too much about having a short focal length telescope. Mm-hmm. Short focal length is fine if it helps you move the telescope around and store it. A short focal length telescope will obviously often have a shorter tube than a longer focal length. We don't care too much about that in the city. In the city, we tend not to be able to use low power and wide field scopes. At low power in the city, you do get a bright sky background.
Right.
So, do not go out of your way to get a short focal length wide field telescope. One is okay. One can be used, but one offers no advantage to, the city observer. City observer, something like an 8-inch F10 SCT or a F6 Newtonian or an F8 or F10 refractor is just fine.
Okay. And I would imagine that someone lives in an apartment, the same advice would apply, but the weight issue comes in, right?
That's right. You know, again, you want the largest aperture that you can lug around and that you can store in your apartment.
Okay.
And for those people, the trade-off may be that to get larger aperture, they need to go to a compound scope like a Schmidt-Cassegrain or a Maxitov-Cassegrain or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
A telescope that incorporates long focal length and a short tube.
Okay.
That's more important, really, than any other advantages. What you're after in the city, again, is aperture and usability. Enough aperture to see something in a package that you can store and move around.
Understood. Now, how about the mount of the telescope? Is an equatorial mount essential for the city, or does it matter?
It depends somewhat on your own circumstances. If you have an open backyard and you tend to just remain in one spot and look in one direction, an equatorial mount that will track the stars is fine. For many of us, though, an equatorial mount isn't so usable. Many of us have to use three or four different spots in our backyard over the course of the evening. You might be able to go in one spot and see off to the east, and to see in the south, you have to go a little bit farther toward the back of your yard so that a shed is blocking Aunt Matilda's backyard security light, and to see to the north, you have to move to another place still.
Right.
If that describes your situation, I would not recommend either a German equatorial mount that you want to polar align and use for go-to computerized operation, nor even an alt-azimuth go-to mount like the modern SCTs.
Mm-hmm.
Both of those are very nice things, but unfortunately, if you have to pick up the scope and move it around over the course of the evening to see different areas of the sky or to hide yourself from streetlights when you're looking in various parts of the sky, you'll have to stop and realign your telescope every time.
Right, and you're looking at another 5 or 10 minutes.
Right, and with a manual German mount, with a manual GEM mount, that's not so bad. You just vaguely point it north, but if you're wanting to use GoTo, then you have to run through, like you say, 5 or 10 minutes of aligning again.
Right.
Maybe for the average person who has to observe like that, a Dobsonian is best, and maybe not just any Dobsonian, maybe a solid tube type Dobsonian. One of those is basically can be picked up in smaller apertures and waltzed around the backyard, in larger apertures, maybe in two trips, and
now, so
doesn't
this is
require a lot of alignment or fussing around.
This is a solid tube as opposed to a truss tube type telescope.
Exactly. By a solid tube, I would mean something like the Orion XT telescopes from Telescope and Binocular Center in the U.S. By a truss tube, of course, we'd mean like the classic Obsession telescopes done by Mr. Kriege.
Right. Or the new Meade Light Bridges, for example.
Right. Or a semi-truss like the Meade Light Bridges.
Now,
are a little bit more difficult to move around without taking apart in the larger sizes.
Okay. Now, so this is interesting. Now, is that because when you move these telescopes, the truss tubes, they come out of alignment?
Well, it's not so much that. It's just that they become very awkward. Now, if you have a large truss tube telescope, there are workarounds. You can put wheelbarrow handles on them.
Okay.
And wheel them around the yard. But for the average person who has to move around the yard 4 or 5 times in the course of the evening, a 12 or 16-inch truss tube scope is really a bit much.
Okay.
You might be better off with a 10-inch or even a 12-inch solid tube scope. It's a little bit easier to handle. It's not quite so awkward to move about. A 12-inch solid tube scope, you can pick up the tube in your arms like a baby, and it's a little heavy, but you can carry it around. A 12-inch truss tube, it's a little bit more iffy to pick it up correctly and move it around without damaging it or yourself, although certainly either can be done.
Okay. Now, you mentioned go-to mounts and go-to telescopes before. They're They're fairly easy to find these days and at a pretty reasonable price. Some purists say that go-to mounts will degrade your observing skills and take away from the pleasure of learning your way around the sky. What do you think?
Well, they're full of crap with a capital K. nothing helps the urban astronomer more than go-to. As I said a moment ago, it may be that if you're continually moving around your property to observe, go-to isn't very practical. But if at all possible, and if you can use go-to, do so. There's a very important reason for that. There are basically two ways to find things, by using go-to or by star hopping. You know, there are other variations too, like setting circles and digital setting circles.
Uh-huh.
But today, basically, it's go-to, digital setting circles, kind of the same thing, or star hopping. Star hopping is when you use a finder scope or a zero-power finder like the Telrad to put objects in your telescope. You observe patterns of stars and constellations and asterisms and locate objects that way. Mm-hmm. And that's fine, and it can be a lot of fun if you're out where you can actually see stars. If you're in the city and you're trying to find the Virgo galaxies and you look inside the arms of the Maiden, where the realm of the galaxies lies, you won't see any stars hardly at all, even with a finder, an optical finder, much less a Telrad.
Mm-hmm.
And how are you going to locate galaxies if you can't find guide stars, signposts along the way? You can't.
Right, right.
Far from making you a worse observer, if you can't ever find anything, you probably will be made into no kind of an observer at all. Your telescope will go in the closet.
You just give up.
Go-to makes it possible for the urban observer to actually see stuff.
Okay. Okay. Now, that's good advice.
No ifs, ands, or buts about that.
I was out trying to looking for galaxies in Pegasus last night, and for one of the few times in my life, I thought, man, I wish I had a go-to.
Well, you really will in the city, where about all you can see is the four stars of the Great Square.
Yes, indeed.
You might see a few more with a 50-millimeter finder, but probably not enough to let you pin down a galaxy when it's been reduced by sky glow and is not quite as obvious in the eyepiece as it normally would be. You see, here's the thing. If you're star hopping, you don't have many stars to hop to, mm-hmm. and you look in the field, you know, you may not notice the galaxy. You may not see it, and you'll move on.
Yeah.
Even if it was in the field. With go-to, if you've got a good go-to telescope that works well and you are assured that most of the time the target will be in your eyepiece field, you will spend a lot of time hunting and looking at that eyepiece field until the galaxy target pops out instead of moving on.
Okay. All right. Let's talk about binoculars for a second. Now, just about every book says how useful binoculars are for astronomy. I found that, myself, I found binoculars in the city don't show me much except for gray sky. What do you think about using binoculars in the city?
Like a finder, they can be. There's no doubt that they're limited by sky glow. That said, I've used binoculars in the city quite a bit, maybe because I'm kind of lazy.
Okay.
And it has to do with living down here on the Gulf Coast, too. You wouldn't believe what summer's like here. It's hot, mm-hmm. it's humid, it's hazy, and there's nothing but mosquitoes. If all I could do was take out a 11 or a 14-inch SCT to observe, I wouldn't observe at all summer long.
Okay.
Right over by the back door, though, is a little table. And on that table is a pair of inexpensive 15x70 binoculars and an Orion Starblast F4, 4-inch Newtonian.
Uh-huh.
All summer long, I use those two, and I've seen a lot. I've seen bunches of little comets in both the binoculars and that short focal length telescope. No, neither one is really optimum for city use.
Mm-hmm.
Lower powers are not what you really want in the city, and yet, if you work at it, even with a pair of binoculars, you will be amazed at what you see in the city. Bottom line, you will see a lot more in the city skies with a pair of binoculars than you will sitting in your chair and watching American Idol. End of story.
Fair enough. All right, so we talked about telescopes and binoculars. Now, When you've got your telescope out and set up, do you use it exactly the same way as you would under a dark sky, or are there some differences? For example,
let me add one thing to the binocular story, that if you have the choice, in the city, instead of 7x50s, get 10x50s, or even better, 15x70s, and we'll get to that in a minute, but a little bit of extra magnification really helps in the city, and that's kind of falls in line with your next question, too. How do you use a telescope in the city? Well, the first thing you'll notice in the city is that low-power eyepieces look horrible. That is because of the sky glow.
I have noticed that, yeah.
And what do you do about that? How do you fight that? Easy. You increase magnification. In the city, we tend, as I said earlier, to use longer focal length telescopes. The reason we do that is because a longer focal length telescope will give you higher power with more comfortable eyepieces.
Okay.
An F10 8-inch telescope will give you a decent magnification of 80 power with a 25-millimeter eyepiece. Why do you use higher magnification in the city? Contrast with a capital C. What a higher power eyepiece does in the city is spreads out the sky glow background.
Okay, so the sky looks darker at higher power.
Darkens the sky a little bit and helps your deep sky objects pop out better.
Okay.
For example, out in the country, you might use a 35-millimeter eyepiece for hunting objects, for finding objects. In the city, you may want to use a 25 or a 20-millimeter instead. And
okay.
Going to higher magnifications doesn't necessarily mean you're looking through a peephole anymore.
Mm-hmm.
There are 70-degree eyepieces, apparent field of view eyepieces, 82-degree apparent field of view eyepieces, and now 100-degree apparent field of view eyepieces.
Yes, from Teleview, yeah.
And, you know,
so
focal length for focal length, they will give you more true field as well and make it easier to find things in the city while keeping your magnification up.
Yeah.
I have both Ethoses, and I swear by them, although they're not for everybody, obviously. They're costly and are something more that the long-time and advanced amateurs will be interested in. But
right.
You can buy an 82-degree apparent field of view eyepiece for less than $100.
Yeah. There were Naglers, and now there's lower-cost ones on the market,
right.
too.
Right, and they may not be as good as Naglers, but they can be big help for city observers. Again, you get fairly high power, but you get a fairly wide true field as well as apparent field with one of these eyepieces, and it helps objects pop out while giving you a decent swath of sky to help you find things.
Right. Now, another obvious accessory, of course, is a light pollution filter. You see the magazine ads about how wonderful these filters are for blocking light pollution. Now, as I understand it, there's three kinds of these filters, broadband, medium band, which filters out more light, and then narrow band line filters that look at a particular spectral line of the object you're looking at. Now, what's your view? Do these filters help for city observing?
I guess the first thing we ought to talk about is what they won't do.
Okay.
What they will not do. What filters, light pollution, LPR filters, will not do, light pollution reduction filters will not do, is help with anything but nebulae.
Okay. So
they
stars.
They will not help with anything made of stars, and that includes stars.
Mm-hmm.
That includes open star clusters,
mm-hmm.
that includes globular star clusters, and that includes galaxies.
Okay.
Unfortunately, the light of the stars falls into the same range of wavelengths as earthly light pollution. So if you're going to block out earthly light pollution, you, as a consequence, are going to block out the light of stars.
Okay.
That being the case, the only thing that a light pollution reduction filter will help is a nebula. But that's a good thing, because nebula are more harmed by light pollution than any other object. Now, there are three kinds of filter that you can buy. A broadband filter, like the Lumicon Deep Sky.
Mm-hmm.
A medium, like the Orion Ultra Block.
Uh-huh.
Or a line filter, like the, say, the Thousand Oaks or Lumicon O3.
Uh-huh.
You can make it easy on yourself, first of all, by Xing out the wide filters like the Deep Sky.
So they don't help.
They don't help enough to do pea turkey for you.
No, this is
some photographers find the wide filters of help in trying to do imaging from the city. Some don't, but they don't do enough to improve the contrast to make them worth bothering with for a visual observer.
Okay, okay.
For most visual observers, those who want to start out with one filter, a medium filter like the UltraBlot or the UHC from Lumicon is what you want. Not only do they provide an incredible gain on nebulae, both in the city and out in the country. By gain, I mean increasing contrast. Obviously, they don't make anything brighter. They can't.
But they
work on many, many objects. An UltraBlot or a UHC-type filter will work on most nebulae. Now, the next step up are the line filters, the O3. Those are incredible filters. They have a couple of drawbacks. Some people will say they don't work. They're very dense filters. Some people will say they don't work well with small aperture telescopes. I've actually had fairly good luck with them on small aperture telescopes. Their main drawback is they don't work with everything. For an O3 filter to work on a nebula, that nebula must be radiating a certain range of frequencies.
From the
doubly ionized oxygen.
Right, right.
The forbidden lines, in other words. A lot of nebulae radiate in those wavelengths, and a lot don't. For example, I've never found M42 to be overly improved by the O3.
Mm-hmm.
Many planetary nebulae, though, are helped a whole lot by an O3.
Definitely, yes.
O3 can be an incredible filter on the Vail Nebula. Probably an O3 is best as your second filter.
Okay.
Then, of course, you can go to the narrowest of line filters, like the H-beta. Mostly those are usable on a few objects like the Horsehead and the California Nebula, objects like that which you won't see from the city anyway, filter or no filter, big telescope or no big telescope. So consider an H-beta only if you want to chase dim ones from dark country skies.
Have you had any luck with hydrogen beta filters with the Horsehead?
Oh, yeah. I just got back from a stargaze where it was quite easy to see the background of the Horsehead, IC-434, with an H-beta, and with just a little looking, Mr. Horse popped right out.
Excellent. Okay.
Which he didn't look like a horse, but I did see him weekend before last with direct vision with an H-beta filter in Chiefland, Florida.
Okay, okay.
But the catch is I was using a 42-inch Dobsonian.
Okay.
But that said, he did look like his pictures with direct vision. No averted vision or averted imagination was required.
A 42-inch, my
42
goodness.
42-inch, known as the Beast.
Yes, yes, I've heard of that telescope.
It rocks.
I wouldn't mind having one myself, or at least taking a peek through one.
A chance to look through it one day. It's worth it.
Well, I will put that on my to-do list for sure.
Put that on your to-do list.
Now, you mentioned finder scopes before. You mentioned non-magnifying finders like the Telrad or Red Dots. A lot of telescopes come with those these days. Are they of much use in the city?
Yes and no. If you're like me, all you use your Blumen finder for is to find alignment stars for either your go-to mount or your digital setting circles.
Okay.
But no, that's a worthy question. If you, like we said earlier, if you don't or can't use go-to or digital setting circles, maybe because you have to move the scope around all the time, that's a valid question. And no, a Telrad or a Red Dot sight is not of much use in the city. The same reason star hopping's hard.
Mm-hmm.
If you can't see many stars with the naked eye, you won't see many stars in your Telrad or zero-power finder. They don't gather any more light than what your eye gathers with its tiny lens.
Okay.
In those cases, you want a minimum of, say, a 50-millimeter optical finder. In the city, that, as I said, can still be very limiting in certain places if the light pollution is so bad that you can't see many stars even with a 50-millimeter finder, and that's true in many locations.
Mm-hmm.
But one is a darn sight better than a Telrad in those conditions.
Okay, so your finder, like your telescope, it's the same story. More aperture will help.
More aperture is better. If you think you want to or you have to star hop, a 50-millimeter finder is good, and 80-millimeter is better.
Okay, okay.
Of course, you don't have to balance that off, but you want to keep a nice wide field, too.
Of course, yeah. You don't want to go too high magnification, or you're looking through a peephole again.
Right. You have hard time. You have to have a finder for the finder, then. You don't want that.
There you go. Yeah. Now, no, exactly. It defeats the purpose for sure. It's that can go on forever. Now, do you? So, when you plan an observing run each night, do you use a particular kind of star map or a software package to plan urban observing?
In the old days, what I would do was I would grab Burnham's Celestial Handbook or the latest column by Scotty Houston and a copy of Sky Atlas 2000, make out a list of objects that I wanted to see.
Yeah,
and that worked pretty well. The important thing is having a list, because if you just trot your telescope out into the back 40 without an idea of what to look at, you won't look at much. You'll come right back in.
Right.
That said, these days I have computerized, and there are three programs that I use. I couldn't recommend one over the other. Deep Sky, Sky Tools, and AstroPlanner.
Okay.
All three of those are basically the same thing. They're very huge databases with charting features as well and a lot of other stuff. And their value is that you can tell them, make me a list of all the galaxies in Virgo brighter than magnitude 10 and higher than 30 degrees in the sky at 9 p.m. on April the 1st, and it will spit a list right out.
Ah, okay.
That is really the only way to fly. And like I said, most of these programs will do fairly good charts or will interface with other charting programs too. If, unfortunately for you, you have to find things the old-fashioned way.
Uh-huh.
If you're lazy like I am, you'll just take your laptop into the backyard, plug it into the telescope, bring up your observing list, click on the first item in your observing list, and send the telescope there.
Oh, wonderful.
But the bottom line is you need an observing list, and the easy way to do it is with one of those three programs, Deep Sky, AstroPlanner, or Sky Tools. They're all very inexpensive, and they can do more to keep you interested than many other things. Any one of those programs will have a database of, 100,000 plus objects.
Well, fantastic.
You'll never run out of things to see, and it makes it so easy to find things to look at that will be in a good spot and bright enough for you to see in the city.
Okay. Now, these are a little bit different than a planetarium-type software package like Stellarium or Starry Night, right?
Well, they will. A lot of them, like I said, include planetarium elements, but that's not the main thrust. The main thrust is it's a big, searchable database.
Okay.
Where you can, like I said, you can search for galaxies brighter than magnitude 10 that are higher than 30 degrees in altitude right now or at 10 p.m. tonight and that are visible from your location.
Okay.
So they are like astronomical databases that help you build a list of things that will be visible to you and your telescope on any given moment.
All right. Now, well, that's great information. Now, when you're out with your telescope, one thing that I've found, I've got my list in hand, I've got my high-power eyepiece, I've got my telescope. I find... something that drives me crazy is that it's hard to get away from street lights or your neighbor's floodlights in their backyard. Have you got any tips to help keep those lights out of
your
eyes?
Well, you have to be creative. In some cases, it may be, like I said, that when you're observing a certain part of the sky, all you have to do is get in the lee of a shed, mm-hmm. and lots is blocked out. As I alluded to earlier, the biggest hindrance to seeing things in the city is not sky glow. I hear people say, well, in my city, the dimmest star I can see is magnitude 2, mm-hmm. yada, yada, yada. Well, that's a bunch of bull hockey usually. Usually what is happening is there are nearby ambient light sources, lights in the immediate area that are shining right into your face, the neighbor security light that keep your pupils constricted, that keep you from achieving any dark adaptation. You could see a lot in your city sky, even with a sky glow, if you could obtain a modicum of dark adaptation.
Okay.
Now, there are various ways to do that. You can go from the simple, like a dark hood or an eye patch, things that keep the light out of your observing eye except when your eye is at the eyepiece, or you can get fancier. If you have a detached house with a nice, secure backyard, you might consider an observatory.
Okay.
And as I say in the book, a lot of my country friends think it's funny that you would want to have an observatory in an urban backyard. But actually, one of the main benefits of an observatory is more of a benefit in the city, that it keeps you blocked from light and wind and things like that. Failing that, you just have to be creative. In the book, I have a section and some photographs and figures on some light shields I made.
Okay.
I went to a play at our local university theater group, Theater USA, and while I was just waiting for the play to begin with Miss Dorothy, I started looking at the stage flats. Now, they're canvas-covered frames of wood. And I started thinking, well, in addition to being stage scenery, a stage flat would make a good light shield. So I went down to the lumber yard and got some 1x4s, and I went to the fabric store and got some cheap muslin and some black paint, and I made a stage flat or two to block light, ambient light, from my observing location in the backyard, and they worked wonders.
Fantastic.
The nice thing about the stage flat idea is they're light and easy to move around. When I moved around the yard, I could move my stage flats. When I moved the scope to a different part of the sky, I could move the flat to block this light or that light.
Okay.
But, you know, anything will work. A tarp hung up on a clothesline or something like that, or a ladder or with a piece of poster stapled to the top of it. Just anything you can devise to put you in a shadow.
Yeah.
So again, the important thing is to block urban ambient light sources, because urban ambient light sources do anything more than anything else to keep you from seeing stuff.
Right. If you're looking at a light, it's going to constrict your pupil.
That's right. You will never get dark adaptation. I think you would be extremely surprised, even from the worst light-polluted cities, how much you can see if your eyes are dark adapted and you're only just dealing with the urban sky glow.
All right. Okay. Well, let's talk about some of the things you can see from the city. Now, of course, many beginners, too, of course, they want to tackle the moon and the planets, Jupiter and Saturn especially, and they make good targets from the city. But what kind of deep sky objects look good? You said, for example, you can see the whole Messier list.
Indeed, you can. But before we leave the subject of moon and planets, what many people don't know is not only can you see the moon and planets from the city, but often they look better from the city.
Why is that?
Often the air above a city, for a variety of reasons, heat signature and other things, is more stable than it is out in the country.
Okay.
But, yes, you can see the entire Messier. Now, when I say you can see the entire Messier, I don't mean you don't have to work at it.
Okay.
If you're going after something like the Ghost Galaxy M74, you're going to, one, wait until your skies are the very best, till a cold front has passed through.
Mm-hmm.
Wait until M74 is as high in the sky as it will get, that is, when it's at culmination, et cetera, et cetera. It may take you weeks to see M74, and when you see M74, all you may see is the core, but you will at least, one, have the satisfaction of saying, I did it!
Right.
And
right.
Two, that by struggling to see M74, you have improved your observing skills so much that you will see a lot more in M74 when you finally get to dark skies than you otherwise would have.
Of course, okay.
But continuing on the subject of what you can see, not everything is hard. Not everything is hard. Open star clusters in particular really aren't hurt much at all by city light pollution, or at least they are not harmed as much as a nebula or a galaxy.
Okay.
So these double stars are always easy.
Okay, yeah.
Globular clusters are fairly easy, especially the bright showpieces. 12-inch telescope will show up an M13 or an M15 or an M2 for just what it is, a big ball of stars.
Mm-hmm.
You won't find it looking as good naturally as it will out in the dark country, but still it'll look darned good.
Okay. Now, what kind of object is, conversely, is too hard to see from the city or is very challenging?
The challenge objects for the city are the challenge nebulae. Even with light pollution filter, as I said, something like the Horsehead, don't waste your time.
Okay.
However, brighter nebulae, like, of course, the Orion Nebula, the Trifid nebula.
Yes.
Nebula in that class, Messier's, are easy, and we're speaking of diffuse nebulae.
Right.
Now, conversely, many planetary nebulae, you know, except the very largest ones, are very easy in the city. M57.
Mm-hmm. The Ring Nebula.
The Ring Nebula, the Blue Snowball that's beautifully obvious right now in Andromeda,
yeah,
are hardly hurt at all by light pollution, and they also respond very, very well to light pollution filters. Going on, galaxies. How about galaxies? Galaxies are easily visible. You can see scads of galaxies.
I notice
the drawback is going to be that you're not going to see the delicate spiral arms that you're going to see from the country.
Okay.
Even a fairly bright galaxy like M51, the Whirlpool, basically you're just going to see two cores instead of M51 and its little companion. But on the other hand, as I said, you can say you saw it. And on some really good night, maybe you can see some detail. And, again, you will be a better observer.
Okay.
Plus, you know, don't count anything out. Many is the time I have trotted out into the backyard down here with a 12-inch telescope and wound up seeing a supernova near the core of a dim NGC galaxy because some buddy of mine called up wondering if I could see it from my horrible skies, and I took on the challenge.
So a supernova.
I guess that's
supernova.
The number one thing in urban astronomy and the number one thing in astronomy altogether. There's no surer way of being proven wrong than to say some observation is, quote, impossible.
So
you never know until you try.
So 2 miles from downtown Mobile, you saw a supernova in another galaxy.
Oh, heck yeah.
Fantastic.
But I turned off the TV, got off my butt, and went out back with the telescope. That's the main factor there.
That's
the first
step. You
have to not just observe, you have to make observing a habit.
Right.
I think William Herschel, arguably the greatest amateur astronomer of all time, you know, had it best. I don't have the exact quote, but he likened observing to playing music.
Yes, yes.
How good a musician would you be if you practiced once a month? Not very good. How
exactly.
good an amateur astronomer or professional astronomer would you be, or telescope operator, or anybody else who has to observe the night sky, if you only did that one time a month?
Exactly, yeah.
If you get out in your backyard every night and try to see the black eye in M64 and finally see a trace of it, you're going to be, again, a heck of a better observer when you do get out to where the skies are really good. If you get out in your backyard all the time and keep in practice, there's less chance that you're going to be completely clueless when you do get out to the Texas Star Party or somewhere really good.
Right, right. You'll know where to find things and how
That's
to look
right.
and how to
and
look
how
at
to
them.
Look for things and how to look at things.
Exactly, exactly. So, if you were told that tomorrow night is your last night on Earth and you could go out with your chosen telescope from your backyard, what would be your favorite one or two or three objects you'd like to look at?
That would be like saying, what are your favorite one or two members of your family?
Okay.
I've been observing the night sky seriously since 1965, and the stars and the planets and the moon and the deep sky objects are my friends. I mean, my wife just finds it amusing. I'll be talking about some distant galaxy as if it's a little buddy of mine, a playmate, positively chuckling over it. But if I just had to say what things would I want to look at before I leave this plane, I keep coming back to the moon. The moon has been a source of enduring interest for me. Jupiter has been a source of enduring interest for me. And then the Messier objects, and especially, you know, I don't have to name them. They trip off of every amateur astronomer's tongue, M42 and M13,
right.
M7 and M8 and M15 and M2 and M31.
Right, right.
I think those 110 objects, those 110 friends of mine, plus our son's little family, I would do my damnedest to see as many of that bunch as I could before I left. And I guess at this time of the year, though, if you're going to pin me down, what would be the one thing I would look at? It would be the Great Orion Nebula M42.
It's a beauty.
I spent last night from a truly dark site observing it with a 13 and 8 millimeter Ethos eyepiece.
Mm-hmm.
Looking at just the countless tiny stars embedded in the tendrils of gas.
Right, right.
I'm looking at the space of dark nebula between M42 and M43, and I've got my iPod on. And all of a sudden, on the iPod comes Enya with her song, To Paint the Sky with Stars. And I almost fell off my observing ladder, bud.
Fantastic. That is fantastic.
Well, it ought to tell you something, though, if I can still retain that enthusiasm after over 40 years.
Well, it's
and the only secret to maintaining your enthusiasm is to get out there and do it.
Yes. Well, you touched on something also. I feel the same way, and many observers who've been doing this for a while feel the same way too, is that these objects are your friends, and no matter what goes on in your life and what changes you endure or even where you move to, they're still there, and they're a source of endless wonder and comfort in a way too.
And that's a very good good observation, because we know this in my head as working on the professional end, teaching astronomy. I know the mm-hmm. heavens are not changeless, but for creatures such as ourselves, just looking up with our eyes, that they appear to be. No matter whatever bad or silly things might happen, that come spring, Virgo will be rising up with her forest of galaxies, and mm-hmm. shortly behind her will be old Hercules with the great glob, and uh-huh. on and on and on, year after year after year. And if I didn't get my fill of M42, he'll still be back next year.
Uh-huh. And they all beat the heck out of American Idol.
You're darn right.
Rod, I appreciate this. There aren't many who specialize in urban observing, so it's great to hear all these tips and tricks, especially from someone who wrote the Bible of urban observing.
Well, that's very kind of you to say so, Brian. Especially kind of you to say that I specialize in anything, because I've never been able to buckle down and specialize in anything in astronomy. You will never find me devoting my life to asteroid photometry.
Well, fair enough.
That's maybe why I enjoy teaching beginning astronomy students in my labs, that we can cover a little bit of everything. And maybe that's the other thing that's kept astronomy fresh for me. I love trying to challenge the heavens in the urban backyard, but I don't mind getting out into a dark site with a big daub either.
Absolutely.
But anyway, I genuinely appreciate you giving me the opportunity to talk to your many, I don't know, what do you call them, listeners, web viewers, whatever they are. Thanks a lot.
Subscribers, friends.
Subscribers, good.
There you go. Well, I'll say that your book, The Urban Astronomer's Guide, has been an inspiration to me over the last few years. It certainly keeps me away from the TV and gets me outside.
Well, and that's what I like to hear, and that's what keeps me writing. And I'm not going to get off without plugging my new one either, if you thought I was.
What have you got in the works?
What I've got coming out is the last book I wrote on Schmidt-Cassegrain and catadioptric telescopes is now nearing 10 years old. So in November, I'm coming out with a book, again, from Patrick Moore's Practical Astronomy series, choosing and using a new cat that covers all the go-to telescopes currently on the market, all the modern telescopes. And while the urban book does have a pretty good section on telescope choice, in this book, because it is just about telescopes, albeit just about compound catadioptric telescopes, I can go into a lot more detail.
Okay, so these are SCTs.
That's due out in November.
In November. And these are
SCTs. Hey, it is November.
Fair enough. It is November 2nd. And so these are SCTs and MACs also.
SCTs, MCTs, KZTs. You'll have to buy the book to find out what that is.
Okay.
And everything in between. Any telescope that uses a lens or a mirror and is for sale to amateur astronomers is in the book.
Okay. And the title again is?
Choosing and Using a New Cat.
Okay. And that's by Springer Verlag.
Springer Verlag's Patrick Moore's Practical Astronomy series.
All right. Great.
They've been very, very good to me.
Yes. No, it's a wonderful series, too. And you maintain a blog also and a website. Can you give us the URL of that?
Yes. All you have to do is to go to my main website, skywatch.brainiac.com/astroland.
Okay.
And Brainiac is just like Superman's old foe, Brainiac. HTTP in front of all that. And there will be a selection for my blog at the top of the page. Or if you want to make life easy on yourself, just go to a website that's a lot of people's favorite, cloudynights.com.
Yes.
They syndicate my blog regularly, and you can read it there, and they probably do a better job formatting it than I do. And you can also get on their message boards and give me your slings and arrows or kudoses about the current blog entry to your heart's content, discuss it, whatever.
Okay. Great, great.
So
yes.
Skywatch.brainiac.com or cloudynights.com, where you can read the Astro blog.
Absolutely. Anyone listening who's not familiar with Rod's work already, I encourage you to check out these websites and books. They're uniquely entertaining and extremely useful. Rod, it was great speaking with you. I really enjoyed it, and thanks very much for doing this.
Anytime, and best wishes and good observing to you and your many subscribers, Brian. Thanks a lot.
Thanks very much.